This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hees Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Heavy fighting continued Monday in South Sudan's capital, Juba, amid fears the country is sliding back into civil war.
That's Jason Patinkin reporting. Details next.
Also, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is gathering information on the condition of civilians in South Sudan after the heavy fighting in Juba. And Somali officials say al-Shabaab fighters temporarily overran a government military base in Lawanta Bor, a former prison about 40 kilometers west of Mogadishu.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, both South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar have ordered a ceasefire following days of conflict in the capital, Juba. The call for the ceasefire came after heavy fighting today in Juba, amid fears the country was sliding back into civil war. Jason Patinkin has more on the story.
South Sudanese government troops shelled a United Nations compound in Juba Monday, where nearly 30,000 civilians had taken shelter from the country's war, causing dozens of casualties. Government forces called SPLA and armed opposition called SPLA-IO have fought in the city for the past 4 days. Several hundred people have been killed, including civilians. Much of the fighting Monday was in the Jebel area near a UN base. There was also fighting near the airport, which has been shut down to all flights. Budbud Chol, who manages security at a health clinic near the base, said government forces fired on the compound.
They are firing heavy artillery toward the camp. So many civilians are wounded.
The camp is called a Protection of Civilians Site, or POC, but Chol said the shelling has caused severe casualties.
Today we have received about 10 of them. In POC 1 and in POC 3, we receive about 72 of them. It means we have 82 of them. So far, we have only 2 deaths. Most of them are inside the camp.
UN peacekeepers are supposed to guard the base. Their mandate calls on them to protect civilians with lethal force if necessary. But Chol said UN troops abandoned their post during the shelling, returning later in the day after civilians had already moved to a safer part of the camp. The camp is home to Nuer citizens who fled there to escape ethnic massacres at the war's start in 2013. The government is mostly Dinka and has accused those sheltering in UN bases of being rebels. Government Army spokesman Lol Ruwai was not available Monday, and UN mission spokesperson Chantal Persaud did not answer repeated calls. The UN Security Council warned Sunday that attacks on civilians and UN installations may constitute war crimes. Diplomats, civil society groups, and ordinary South Sudanese have called on both sides to stop the fighting. But the U.S. Embassy said Monday that a ceasefire has not been achieved. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Nairobi.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressed the situation in South Sudan today, condemning the violence.
The renewed fighting is outrageous. It is yet another grievous setback. It deepens the country's suffering. It makes a mockery of commitments to peace. Many people have been killed in heavy fighting. There are growing fears that many more could die in another round of violence. Let me start by expressing my deep condolences to the families and loved ones of all those who have been killed in the fighting that has consumed Juba over the past 4 days. I condemn the killing of 2 Chinese peacekeepers and 1 UN national staff. I'm appalled by these indiscriminate attacks on civilians and peacekeepers.
He said various UN sites had been damaged in the fighting. Mr. Ban directed criticism at South Sudanese leaders.
Yet again, the leaders of South Sudan have failed their people. Rarely has a country squandered so much promise so quickly. What kind of leadership is it that resorts to deadly weapons and identity politics? Time and again, failed leadership. My message to President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar is clear. Do everything in your power to de-escalate the hostilities immediately. Order your respective forces to withdraw to their bases. Let me underscore again to all those leading and perpetuating those hostilities that acts of violence perpetrated against civilians and the United Nations and humanitarian personnel, assets, and premises may constitute a war crime. There must and will be accountability for the atrocities that have been committed in South Sudan since 2013. It is not just the leaders who must face a reckoning, but all those in the chain of command, including chiefs of staff and other officials complicit in the violence. The international community, through its wide-ranging security, legal and human rights mechanisms, will be carefully monitoring developments in the coming days precisely in order to be able to identify on whom the burden of accountability for war crimes should ultimately be placed.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking today about South Sudan.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, says the Security Council has expressed its readiness to enhance UNMISS, the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan. The goal would be to help provide security. She says the Security Council has called on neighboring states to prepare troops for possible deployment. The U.S. has condemned the latest fighting. Also, the State Department has issued a travel warning urging U.S. citizens not to travel to South Sudan.
For reaction to the latest crisis in South Sudan, VOA's Jody Kapawa spoke with former South Sudanese Defense Minister Majak Agut. He began by giving his views on why fighting broke out last week and continues today.
Well, at the broad brush, this is a breakdown of command and control. The peace agreement has been put in place, and all the parties have assembled in Juba, and the government of national unity has been established. Yet the parties did not effect the cessation of hostilities and a comprehensive ceasefire simply because of gaps in command and control in both camps.
So you would say both sides are to blame for the current situation?
Well, both sides are to blame for the current situation because since the signing of the peace agreement, ceasefire has never been observed. There have been numerous skirmishes in a number of places. There have been clashes in Wau, in Raja, in Kansum near Kajukeji, and all over the country. Access has always been denied to humanitarian agencies. And so, in fact, we have peace agreement in paper. A government of national unity was constituted in Juba, but there was no peace in the country because ceasefire was not being observed.
So what can be done at this stage to at least get control of the situation and stop the fighting?
The proposals that were put on the table in Addis was to completely demilitarize Juba of troops, of the warring parties. That was reversed by the IGAD summit in Kampala, and the arrangement of troops of both sides being stationed in the national capital was put on the cards. I think at this stage, what is urgently needed is to completely demilitarize Juba and some of other important centers of administration in South Sudan so that if the fighting breaks out, it does not affect the civil population, one. Number two is to revise the security arrangement framework that was put in place so that something is urgently done with regards to putting together the national army and the national police. Because as per the peace agreement, in like 18 months, we're supposed to have a national army. We are now on the 11th month, and not even one step has been taken in that regard.
So to demilitarize Juba, would that be a voluntary operation, or could UNMISS do it, or neighboring countries?
Well, at this stage, I don't think it's going to be a voluntary exercise, but it would require a lot of buy-in, a lot of discussion with the warring parties. What you have seen on the 7th, when the shootout occurred in the palace, and President Salva and Vice President Riek came out and said that they didn't know what was happening in their immediate surrounding, shows that the two men are not in control. So we have to embark on a buy-in approach where other warlords who are now calling the shots are brought on board so that they are told the importance of demilitarizing the national capital. If that is not done voluntarily, I think other measures will have to be sought so that the national capital is free of armed men and militias.
Now, when you mention other warlords, can you give me an idea of exactly who you're talking about? You're talking about various military commanders?
Yes, military commanders on both sides are the ones calling the shots now, particularly on the government side. The warlords are calling the shots, some militias all over the place who are not directly under Riek Machar. So there are so many warlords around, and these warlords who can really have a special bearing on the effectiveness of the ceasefire will have to be brought on board.
That was Dr. Maja Kagut, former South Sudanese defense minister. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is gathering information on the condition of civilians in South Sudan after heavy fighting broke out in Juba. UNHCR has been providing health care, education, shelter, and livelihood opportunities to South Sudanese refugees and those who are internally displaced. Leo Dobbs, the UNHCR Senior Communications Officer for Africa, says preparations are being made to provide basic necessities if needed. He expressed concern that the fighting does not lead to another civil war.
Well, I should start off by saying that it would be tragic if this fighting ended up plunging the country back into war, especially now when they've just achieved 5 years of independence. But the situation inside South Sudan is just very muddy at the moment. We believe that many people have sought shelter in UN bases. I think our own staff are in a safe compound, sheltering from the fighting that has taken place in Juba over the weekend. It seems that the fighting has affected some borders. At the Uganda-South Sudan crossing, it seems as though very few people are getting across since the fighting erupted on Friday. Security has been tightened on the South Sudan side. And this has led to a significant decrease in the number of new arrivals coming into Uganda over the weekend. On Saturday, just 95 people crossed, and this dropped to 36 on Sunday, which compares with a daily average of 167 in July and 171 for June. We are expecting a higher level of new arrivals once the border reopens. We don't really have much news from other borders, but in western Ethiopia's Gambela region, which borders South Sudan, we've stepped up border monitoring with Ethiopia's own refugee officials. And we've also got emergency preparedness in hand in case of a major influx.
Do you have any information regarding the UN House camp where there are 28,000 people who have been previously uprooted by war?
No, I don't have any more information at the moment. And we're trying to gather more information and see what the situation is like. So we put out a call to our various officers where the surrounding countries which are hosting refugees and also inside. So obviously, you know, there's a security concern at the moment.
You mentioned that you all are gearing up, you're preparing just in the event there is a need that people have to start moving. So what things are you all putting into place right now?
Well, I mean, getting in place shelter, for example, and also getting in place basic kits for utensils and mat for sleeping on and the basics, the very basics that people need to stay alive. And of course, our fellow agencies like the World Food Programme will be also preparing shipments that can be sent to border areas if numbers start rising and people come across the border.
That was Leo Dobbs, the UNHCR Senior Communications Officer for Africa. He spoke with me from Geneva.
The New York-based Human Rights Watch is condemning the fighting in South Sudan and calling on the UN Security Council to impose an arms embargo to end the hostilities. Akshay Kumar is the Deputy United Nations Director at Human Rights Watch. She told the reporter Ayan Bior that implementing an arms embargo would immediately ground South Sudanese attack helicopters and limit the ability of armed forces to target civilians.
The Secretary General of the UN made an incredibly important call just a few minutes ago. He finally very clearly and unequivocally came out in favor of an arms embargo on South Sudan. This has been an issue that's been kicked around the Security Council for months and months and months. But to have the Secretary General speak out in favor, I think, is incredibly important, and hopefully the Council will listen.
And what difference will an arms embargo on South Sudan make?
Well, pragmatically, we think that an arms embargo would eventually, in the mid and long term, reduce violations and human rights abuses against civilians that are being committed with heavy weapons like shells and mortars. I just heard about a maternity ward getting shelled earlier today in South Sudan, in Juba. And then more specifically, operationally, we're hopeful that the foreigners who are operating attack helicopters on behalf of the SPLA and maintaining them, the ones who are really enabling those helicopters to fly in the sky and wreak the terror and havoc that they're wreaking and fire missiles on even UN installations, will be prevented from doing so, because a global arms embargo would prevent not only selling weapons to South Sudan, but also selling the kind of assistance and technical support and operational know-how that happens.
But South Sudan's neighbors have to be in support of the arms embargo. So with that in mind, could you tell me about some of the challenges that we might have in enacting or imposing this arms embargo on South Sudan?
What we do know is that 15 members of the UN Security Council need to vote in favor of the embargo, and that includes three African countries, Egypt, Angola, and Senegal. But that's it. Once those 15 countries vote, then a global embargo is in force. And so anybody who continues to sell weapons or material or provide support militarily to South Sudan's combatant forces would be against international law. As you said, enforcement, of course, will rely a lot on the region, because that's how arms get into the country. But I want to be clear that actually imposing the embargo itself is something that can happen solely through the Security Council and requires just those 15 countries to come to a decision.
That was Akshay Kumar of Human Rights Watch. She spoke to reporter Ayan Bior from New York.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Ihe Isuhi, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our stories. Heavy fighting continued today in South Sudan's capital, Juba, amid fears the country is sliding back into civil war. Also, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is gathering information on the condition of civilians in South Sudan after the heavy fighting in Juba. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Somali officials say al-Shabaab fighters temporarily overran a government military base in Lanta Bor, a former prison about 40 kilometers west of Mogadishu. The militants attacked the base around 1:30 this morning, local time. A security official says at least three soldiers were killed, but other officials say they fear a heavier loss of life. Al-Shabaab militants claim to have killed more than 30 government soldiers, but their claim cannot be independently verified. In other news on Somalia, VOA's Somali service says officials and residents report al-Shabaab has taken control of the strategic port town of Mirka, 100 kilometers south of the capital. Government troops and the AU peacekeepers who had controlled the town withdrew at dawn this morning.
A new report says in-depth, comprehensive journalism is at risk around the world, whether it be from physical attacks on reporters or limited budgets for news organizations. The report warns that truth is being suppressed. VOA's Jody Kepawa reports.
Index on Censorship magazine calls its report Danger in Truth, Truth in Danger. Rachel Jolly is the editor.
There's a two-edged sword there, isn't there? I was looking at journalists coming under fire from all sorts of areas, lots of different types of pressure, not just physical violence, but fines, psychological pressure. And I wanted to talk about how, for the rest of us, there's a sense that we might not find out the truth as years go by, because it becomes more dangerous to tell the public the truth. Not only are journalists in danger, but the truth is in danger as well.
Physical attacks include murder and kidnappings. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 73 journalists were killed last year. And at the time this story was being produced, 17 had been killed this year. The Index on Censorship report says that in Iraq, providing safety training is not only necessary, but a duty for organizations who care about journalists and activists in dangerous zones. It says in some countries, including Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen, veteran journalists often find it impossible to do their jobs. The report cites an increasing trend to label journalists as extremists or terrorists, so governments can crack down on their reporting. Legislation in some countries prohibits coverage that might be critical of government officials. And then Jolly says there's financial pressure from smaller budgets.
On one level, there's the threat of the way that finance to journalism is changing journalism. So how journalists are doing fewer and fewer in-depth news reports, they're just under pressure to write stories quickly. So in a sense, that's where we miss out on finding out the in-depth investigative stuff.
She says newspapers have much smaller budgets and staffs, so it's less likely they can do the type of investigative reporting used in the 1970s U.S. political scandal known as Watergate. It forced President Nixon to resign. Or the more recent expose of Catholic priests sexually abusing children. It was portrayed in the Academy Award-winning film Spotlight. Jolly describes it as the graft and the grind reporting.
The days when journalists were given days to go and explore a story and really dig into something and have the opportunity to do something like go through huge documents, look at the detail, and really expose what might be going on, those are getting fewer and fewer. I mean, of course, there are a few journalists out there doing that, but the numbers and the commitment to that kind of journalism is disappearing.
Jolly says even social media, such as Twitter, can have a negative impact on news coverage.
Social media, in one sense, is a great and exciting innovation where you can find out information. But on the other hand, it's being used to suppress information as well. We've seen governments put lots of money into their PR machine, but not just in a straightforward pumping out the positive stories way, but taking on journalists and trying to undermine their reputation, to attack journalists and counter their stories and undermine their image internationally and nationally.
The Index on Censorship magazine editor says many journalists have lost their status as an observer. Jolly says even militant groups like Islamic State have their own media and do not need journalists to get their story told. She says there's also a growing trend of celebrity journalism, coverage of the rich and famous and their latest escapades. She adds that if average citizens demand to know what their governments are doing, the media will respond with more and better coverage. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. In the afterglow of America's Independence Day celebrations, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss what independence has meant and means for Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.